The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A very warm welcome to all of you to this live session at WideMote Investing Summit 2020. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to MOI Global Gary Mishuris, Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer of Silver Ring Value Partners, an investment firm with a concentrated long-term intrinsic value strategy. Gary also teaches the Value Investing Seminar at Olin Business School. Before founding Silver Ring Value Partners in 2016, Gary was a Managing Director at Manulife Asset Management since 2011, where he was the lead portfolio manager of the U.S.-focused value strategy. From 2004 through 2010, Gary was a vice president at Evergreen Investments. I've had the pleasure of meeting Gary in person at Idea Week St. Moritz, greatly enjoyed our conversations there, have learned a lot from you, Gary, over the years, including from your past presentations at our conferences, and I very much look forward to this one as well. Feel free, everybody listening, to type your questions into the online interface at any time, and we will get to them after Gary's presentation. And now, Gary, I'd like to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate that introduction, and thank you for everyone listening. I appreciate your time. And also, I would have to say, John, thank you for the community you've built and for the service you've done for us long-term investors, because I think bringing us together and introducing like-minded people to each other in a high-quality setting is something that's always been very valuable, and it's probably more valuable today when some of us are anyway stuck at home and so forth. So thank you for that. So today I'm going to present a company by the name of Covetrus. The ticker is CVET. And again, I'll try to be semi-brief. Brevity is not my strong suit, but I'll try. And then welcome all questions at the end. I'm going to skip my bio because John did such a great job. I also, I'll skip the Silver Ring Value Partner slides. This is not what you're here for. It's a little bit of the firm, but basically it's a long-term intrinsic value concentrated partnership. Now I'll get right to the part that hopefully you were interested in, which is Covetrus. So the very brief thesis summary here, I think it is a competitively advantaged and non-cyclical business. It has two businesses kind of in one, which are somewhat different, even though they serve the same vertical. And the first business is an underappreciated SaaS business that's growing 40% plus with a long runway for future growth. And we also have a kind of a mature business, an animal health distribution business with stable economics. Now, this is a merger spin-off that occurred in 2019. So there's some spin-off accounting, and also this is the early stage of the SaaS business that's making it a little bit hard to see the real long-term economics of this business, which is why I think the opportunity exists. It's not something you can easily screen for and say, oh, okay, it's a 5x earnings, it's cheap, and look at it. You have to understand the business a little bit more to really see the opportunity. We have a new CEO who I like, at least my initial impression is favorable, who's turning around the distribution business. The balance sheet has recently been strengthened, and I would say it's pretty safe regardless of what path COVID or the economy takes. And the stock is under two-thirds of my intrinsic value estimate, despite the run-up. So I still think that there is a substantial opportunity here to be had. So with that, let me dive in. So the first of the two businesses is the animal health distribution business. So what they do is basically they take stuff being two-thirds drugs and one-third other supplies from manufacturers like animal drug companies like Zoetis, for example, and distributing it to veterinarians. And the business was spun off from Henry Schein in 2019, and it's pretty resistant to the recessions. It actually grew meaningfully through the 08-09 cycle, for example. Incidentally, it's also considered essential during this cycle, and we can talk about that in a little bit, but it's actually, I believe, the industry is back in growth, flat to growing mode right now, which is not something that many industries can say. It's the concentrated oligopoly with Covetrus and two other competitors, one Patterson Companies, which is a publicly traded company with the ticker PDCO, and the second one is MWI Vet Services, and that's owned by AmerisourceBergen, which is a mostly a human drug distributor. And these three companies control the majority of the market. And they serve a very fragmented veterinary market that is also pretty reliant on the profits that these guys distribute to them for their own kind of survival and profits. So that's the animal health distribution business. It's a mature business. It's a moderately growing business, but it has very stable economics. It's non-cyclical. It's a nice business. So I'll kind of give you a little bit of overview. It's also a global business. You can see in the top chart, but half of the sales comes from North America, and the rest is split between EU and Asia. And North America is actually even more important in terms of profits. It probably accounts for about 3/4 of the profitability of the business. In the bottom chart, you can see the historical organic sales growth of the business. It's averaged around 6% over the last decade. So there's not a ton of businesses which are mature and where that's the case. You know, it used to be that CPG companies like Procter & Gamble and whatnot could deliver those results. But I would encourage you to compare this set of organic growth rates over a decade to many other companies that are in the much kind of mature, not very cyclical space. And I don't think there are that many, even though 6 does not sound like that high. I think a solid 6 has been a very good showing. So if we go to the next business, which is, I would argue, potentially the more valuable of the two, even though it's probably a far wider range of outcomes business, it's a business called Vets First Choice. And so what happened during the spinoff is Henry Schein spun off the distribution business and merged it with a private startup or kind of late stage startup called Vets First Choice in 2019. And that's how Covetrus was born. The value proposition of Vets First Choice to the vet is straightforward. They install software, that's a kind of web-based or online-based software as a service kind of program. And the vet gets two things. From a standard of care point of view, it helps them get better compliance with medications for the, for the pets. And but the main thing really from an economics point of view, it shifts the revenue back into the vet channel that would otherwise go to other channels like online pharmacy. So just to explain a little bit more, because I think this is important so we understand what we're talking about, so like heartworm medication or flea medication, a lot of it has left the vet channel. And now people fulfill that at petmeds.com, or they can now fulfill it at Chewy, that started an online pharmacy about a year ago. So those are all ways to they can get that. But imagine if you're going to the vet, and you basically are, having your appointment, and then they say, hey, Fluffy needs his heartworm medication when you get home. And you get home, and in your email box, there's an email and says, hey, we just saw Fluffy. We talked about him getting, heartworm medication. Click here. We'll fulfill that for you. So now the customer clicks and fulfills, and now the vet, using Covetrus' fulfillment capabilities and front-end and back-end, essentially, gets to capture that revenue and profit. And the way that Vets First Choice makes money is that it takes a percentage of that, about 25% of the total revenue going through goes to them. And that's the take rate, but it's incremental. It's not business that the vet otherwise would have. And as you guys probably know, at least some of you know, vets do not make a lot of money. You don't become a veterinarian because you want to make the big bucks. And a lot of times it's out of love for animals and wanting to help them, and a lot of times people don't make very much money, so every little bit helps, and it's a attractive proposition. So Vets First Choice, the software, is now installed in over 40% of U.S. vet clinics, and it's the clear dominant number one. They're in the process of contemplating a starting entry into the EU, but that's still in very early stages. And, importantly, this business has been growing for over 30% for years. So this is not like, oh, they had a good quarter or 3/4 or 4/4. It's been kind of one of those, S-curve early stage businesses that's been growing, growing. And recently that business even accelerated further because the COVID crisis actually accelerated adoption among the vets, because now the customer really wants that for capability. And maybe some of that medication could have been bought over the counter somewhere, or they just want the ease of use. And and the other part of it is that the vets did see some traffic drop off. People are delaying non-urgent visits and so forth. So it's a little easier to say, hey, I know maybe you lost 10% of your traffic, Mr. Vet, but we have a way for you to make incremental revenue, another 90%. That's good for you. It's good for your pets. It's good for the customer. It's good for everyone. So it's not a hard sell. It's a easy proposition with very little, if any, upfront cost. and most of the revenue coming as a revenue share over time, providing a recurring revenue stream over the time being. And so here's an example on slide 9. I took it from Covetrus's 2019 Analyst Day, and then just walk through kind of the increasing refills as an example where Vet's First Choice, using these this integrated software package that knows when the refills are due, doesn't let the client forget that their course in this case is due for a refill. That's kind of a simple use case, but there are others as well. So let's jump in, and I'm going to talk about how I analyze these companies. And I think just a reminder for those for whom it's the first time listening to my presentations, I use a 5-step research process. So step number one, we're going to try to figure out company quality. I think that's probably one of the most important steps. And if a company doesn't pass the steps frequently, unless there's some kind of hard asset value, something unique, I'm probably just going to stop right there. Step two is analysis of key economic variables, figuring out what really drives the business and what's a reasonable range of values for each of those. Step three is financial modeling, which is translating the insights from step two into a range of financial outcomes for the business. Step four is valuing the resulting scenarios. And then step five is a behavioral checklist where we basically make sure that we confront our behavioral biases head on, because we all have them. Well, maybe you don't. I know I do, and I know I'm never going to be able to eliminate them, but I can at least try to mitigate them to a degree by trying to do this. So overall, the goal of this 5-step research process is twofold. First, we want to figure out how predictable is the long-term outcome of this business, right? Because a lot of businesses where we have no idea what it's worth. It could be worth zero, it could be worth 1,000, who knows, right? And maybe some numbers are more likely to some degree, but it's just such a wide range, we just don't know. So we want to figure out how predictable, what makes this business predictable? What are the characteristics that make us say, hey, we can look out 5-10 years into the future and approximately say, here's what this business is going to do in terms of free cash flow, profitability, return on capital, and so forth. And then what is a reasonable range of intrinsic values? And then we can use that as an input into our decision as to whether we want to buy the stock or not, or other securities of the company, and how much. So without further ado, so step one, company quality assessment, really is comprised of three parts. The first is business quality, which is industry structural attractiveness plus the company's sustainable competitive advantage, if any. The second is management quality, which is track record of operations and capital allocation, as well as an alignment of incentives. And the third is balance sheet quality. And that's ability to withstand temporary adversity without reducing security value. So let's dive into step one. Starting with a fortified forces analysis, I think this business is I'm talking about the animal health distribution industry. I think it's of above average structural attractiveness. And I say that because I think the favorable parts of supporter analysis is that we have high barriers to entry and we have low power buyers. And I'll talk about that in a second. I mean, somewhat offsetting that is we do have powerful suppliers and there are some threats of substitution. But at least, in my view, this still doesn't lead to severe price competition or commodity business. And frequently, the competition is geared around service and individual salesperson relationship and so forth. So this is not necessarily a cutthroat business where people are trying to bleed margins dry, but nor is it a luxurious business where you can just relax and not focus on execution and still have fat profits in there. So I think it's an above average business, and I'll walk through why. So barriers to entry. So if you think about it, first of all, if you wanted to enter, you would need a large scale sales force because there are over 20,000 vet clinics in the US and you need to call on them to sell them stuff. And you can't enter with just a few salespeople, I don't think effectively, because it just doesn't make sense. You don't have the minimum efficient scale for the warehouses and so forth. So you need to invest a lot in the sales force. You need to have large purchasing power to have profitable deals with manufacturers, because the manufacturers want you to drive the volume. And they have the incentives around certain thresholds of volume. And so if you can't meet them, you're not going to get a very good deal and you're going to be at a cost disadvantage. Also, vets are busy. They don't really want another person soliciting them and saying, hey, can I take you out? Like, well, no, you can't take me out. I don't know. You already have my two reps from the two distributors that I use. Go away. I'm too busy. Right. So that's a barrier. And also, most distributor salespeople have non-compete agreements, which prevent them from working for a competitor in their prior area of coverage. So what that means is that if you had the great idea, like, hey, I'm going to go and I'm going to hire all of Covetrus's salespeople because they're so great, and I'm going to just start my own business, you couldn't do that necessarily. So I think barriers to entry are high. Power buyers is low because we have fragmented customers. We have vets who are price takers. They're not really thinking about how to, you know, get, you know, leverage some their suppliers or anything like that. Not really sophisticated. People aren't going into that business because they're masters of business. They're going there because they love animals and they want to help. And for them, running the business is just a necessary part of being able to practice their craft. So buyer power is low. On the other hand, the power of suppliers is high. The suppliers are a concentrated oligopoly. Suppliers have been consolidating. The trend is still continuous. This, you know, the latest is Elanco in the process of finalizing the acquisition of Bayer's business. The silver lining is that as suppliers consolidate, they do sometimes consolidate their distribution with fewer, bigger distributors, which does favor Covetrus, Patterson, and WI. But that's not necessarily always the case. And I think the threat of forward integration via self-distribution is very low. It's not really economical. If you think about, let's say you have three different drugs that do the same thing, you know, it's much more economical for have one sales force distributing all three than it is to have three different sales forces. It just, you know, economically doesn't make sense. So that's why, you know, as long as the customers stay fragmented, you will always need distributors. Threat of substitution, it's real. You know, it's not, I don't think it's particularly high, but it's real because you do have online pet pharmacies that have been taking market share from in-clinic, from the in-clinic model. You also recently have Chewy, which, you know, just a great company, you know, services the customers really well. I've been a customer for a long time. And, you know, they started about a year ago to roll out their online pet pharmacy. And I get, you know, their emails saying, hey, 20% off, you know, come, you know, here's a code, enter it and buy from us. And they're a threat. They're definitely a threat. I think it's they're also particularly a threat because historically vets have underpriced services. So like when you get the bill, the amount they charge for their time or for, you know, performing some procedure is lower than maybe it should be, but they've overpriced the drugs with the fat markups, which allows them to then make money on the sale of the drug. Good, that's maybe temporarily was good for the vets, but the problem was now it allows someone who's online and has a lower cost structure to undercut the vets on the pricing of the drugs. One positive offset is that recently manufacturers started reinforcing the minimum pricing requirements. And that prevents some of these competitors from truly taking the prices way too low and eroding profitability. But ultimately, though, what makes me comfortable that this is not an existential threat is that basically vets don't make much money, and you really cannot take their drug profitability away from them and expect the clinic model to survive. And we need vets, right? It's not like we have too many vets, and you know, we just need to get rid of half the industry or something like that. And so. Manufacturers still need to distribute service to vets, and as long as the vets have the drug, you know, sales to a large degree, even if online does gain share as I expected to, I think that the business model is intact. But it is a risk, and it's something I've thought about, and something I'm keeping an eye on. If we then move on to competitive intensity, you know, the industry is pretty concentrated. The three large players control the majority of the market. I don't have exact market shares because a number of smaller competitors are private, and now MWI is part of AmerisourceBergen, who doesn't really break it out that well. I think competition is based in relationships and service much more than price, and there's really not a big difference in, between the three large players, which is good and bad. I mean, there's no one has a competitive advantage versus the other two, but I think that you also have the three combined have a degree of scale competitive advantage against the smaller players, the regionals. And so I think that, you know, they're not going in there trying to move prices to the rock bottom. They're going in there trying to be responsive and do the usual kind of high touch sales call and say, hey, Mr. Vet, you're busy. I'm going to save you time and be efficient. We have a great assortment and so forth. And historically, the market has grown mid-single digits, which does alleviate some competitive pressure because there's the pie is, you know, expanding, which helps, you know, keep everyone happy without needing to really fight really hard for market share. So source of competitive advantage. I think the dominant position and install base for Vet's First Choice in the online animal retailing for vet practices software business is a really big advantage. It's, I think, likely a winner-take-most, if not a winner-take-all kind of business model because the switching costs are high. And on the distribution side, we have reputation, Salesforce relationships, and comparable scales with other two large competitors. So I do think the company has a decent competitive advantage. As a validation, I would say the return on tangible capital in 2019 was over 30%, despite this being a pretty bad year and almost no contribution from Vet's First Choice, which was around break-even due to the high growth rate in that year. So management quality. If you look at the history, you had a founder CEO of Vet's First Choice, Ben Shaw, and he became the first CEO of Covetrus when the merger and spin-off happened in 2019. He was replaced by the board late 2019, because it became apparent that the business was really underperforming and they needed someone to come in and help and fix that. So they turned to the new CEO, who was also Ben, name I'm fond of. My son, my oldest son, is a Ben, so maybe there's a behavioral bias there. I don't know. But he was a board member at Covetrus at the time. But previously, he was a founder and CEO of Everyday Health, which after over a decade run was acquired by J2 Global for over $400 million. So he definitely had experience scaling up a small business and also managing a sizable business at the end. There's also strong board oversight, I would say. The PE firm Clayton, Dubilier & Rice is a major shareholder, and they have two board seats. And we also have the CFO of Henry Schein, which was where the company was spun off from, the distribution business was, who is excellent and knows the business well on the board. So I think we have pretty good oversight here, and there's not going to be a case of some runaway CEO doing some random stuff without the board stepping in. I would say for the track record, it's too early, right? The CEO just took over late last year. We don't know how successful he'll be at Covetrus. I do say that the initial signs are encouraging. For one, and this is an important point, the distribution business stopped losing market share in Q1. And my conversation with the CEO, who I talked to recently over Zoom, as is the method of most people these days, I think he's humble. I think he's realistic about the challenges. And he's focused on just hard-nosed execution rather than grandiose plans. And I think that's good. The Glassdoor ratings have started to show improvement, although the sample is small. And you can see that in the top of slide 20, things got pretty bad, and there was a kind of uptick when the CEO took over, but there's still a long way to go. I would say the alignment of incentives is okay, but not ideal. We're talking about sales, EBITDA, and cash flow combined with options and restricted stock, kind of the usual mix. The CEO was granted options and restricted stock units that were valued about $3.5 million at market, but that was at a pretty depressed stock price. And I would say that based on my intrinsic value base case, the value of that grant is probably closer to $10 million. So he has a substantial, he's in his early 40s, but he's probably has a decent financial motivation to build value here over time. So I would say my conclusion is not enough yet evidence about that the management is above average, but that's kind of direction I'm leaning in. But I don't think it's a strong read yet just because it's too early and I don't want to say that they're above average just because I like the CEO. I want to wait for evidence of that in terms of execution at Covetrus. So moving on to the balance sheet. So what's important for balance sheet analysis is you want a business that can withstand temporary adversity without needing to raise capital, and you want appropriate leverage relative profitability that doesn't necessitate the use of free cash flow to reduce debt. And the company started its life with a $1.2 billion term loan because it's one of those usual deals where the spin sends a big fat dividend check to the parent, and then at the expense of doing a hefty amount of borrowing up front, which has been pretty standard recently, for better or for worse. The original management, unfortunately, was pretty overly optimistic about its ability to execute and also this financial target. So what looked like at $1.2 billion was pretty benign level of debt, especially for a non-cyclical company with growth. All of a sudden, it started looking like a tight fit. The good news is the language of the loan agreement is fairly loose. For example, they permit management to count various announced actions as soon as they're announced towards EBITDA run rate and ratio calculation. So it's pretty hard to trip these covenants. You can always announce something credible, like if you need to really just survive, right? So this is not a business that's going to be put in bankruptcy by, triggering loan covenants. But nonetheless, the CEO decided to do a capital raise in April of 2020. Now, that seems like years ago, and the stock market is in a very different place today. But if you recall, you know, the stock market was dropping in March, everything was falling apart, people didn't know how serious everything was going to be. And you know, I did ask the CEO, like, why did you do this? You know, I'm curious, you know, what was your decision process for this raise? Because the raise was expensive. So they raised $250 million in proceeds to reduce loan amount as a perpetual convertible preferred from Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, one of the largest shareholders, and with a strike of $11 and a 7.5% dividend payable in cash in kind. And I think what he said is he wanted to take any liquidity fears off the table because he didn't want the ecosystem, whether customers or manufacturers, to worry about their viability. So it wasn't so much about tripping covenants. It was more about just taking this as a distraction off the table to allow management to focus on turning the business around without having the balance sheet hanging over them. So that did bring out down my value. We'll talk about it later. But I think the result of that, though, is that the company, which also sold a non-core business for about $100 million in the EU, is in a pretty good shape. The pro forma leverage now stands at 3.5 times net debt to EBITDA, and that on a bank-defined basis. And that compares to a current covenant of 5.5 times, stepping down to 5 times in a year. So the probability of tripping these covenants in the currency is very, very low. And I think that leverage is appropriate for the current business. So if we go and look at what economic variables we want to understand going forward to really get this business right, I would say there are four things we want to know. One is the ability of the company to turn around the distribution business and grow in line with the industry. Two is the degree of economic pressure from manufacturer consolidation. And three, the impact of growth in online pharmacies on the vast drug sales. And finally, four is the penetration and degree of in-practice utilization of the vet's first choice software as a service platform. So starting with distribution sales growth, as you saw previously, the company grew through the last recession, averaged around 6% organic growth without much cyclicality. The merger spin, though, did cause a lot of distraction among the sales force, and they did lose meaningful share. You can see there's no bar here in 2019. That's not a mission. It's just because the growth rate was zero. And the good and the bad news here is that competitors did grow. I did talk to Patterson Dental, Patterson Companies. They have a dental business. It used to be called Patterson Dental, and they have an animal health business that competes with Covetrus. And I did research on the third competitor, MWI, and both of those businesses grew meaningfully in 2019. That's the good news. And the reason I think that's good is while that implies that the company did lose share, which we kind of know already, it also implies that this is not some sinister secular structural issue that you know is affecting everyone, and that's beyond the management's ability to turn around. So I think that this is a company-specific problem with the industry still showing healthy growth. I also think that you know, it is important that we saw the first quarter in Q1 where the company for the first time did not lose market share. We'll see if that's sustainable. You know, one quarter doesn't make a trend. Another thing I did is I did a bunch of research around the sales force to try to understand what has been the sales force turnover, if any, because one negative scenario would be let the best producers say left, and now you have this gutted sales force that doesn't have the same caliber of people that can sell with the relationships with the vets, and that's not the case. I checked with LinkedIn, I also checked with competitors about that, and found out that the salespeople have non-competes for the area, so they can't, even if they wanted to, you know, Covetrus rep can't go and start working his own old territory for, say, MWI. That's not allowed. And, you know, he could probably go somewhere else, but A, he would have to move probably, and B, he has the know-how of how to build relationships, but it's a much longer ramp to start from scratch versus you taking your existing book of business over to the, you know, to a new employer. So, which they're not allowed to do. So, that's good. And they have a new head of North America recently hired who was a CEO previously of a distribution business. So he knows how to run one. And I think that they're kind of green shoots in this business. It's not, you know, proof. You know, I'm not trying to overrepresent how much positive evidence there is, but I think there's evidence that things are not getting worse, and then there's evidence that the industry itself is fine, and there's some evidence that they're starting to turn the corner, but I expect it to take some time. It's not going to happen instantaneously. And as far as manufacturer consolidation online pharmacies are concerned, I would say that That is a negative. I think that there will be continued pressure on the business from supplier consolidation. I think that the economics will slightly shift towards manufacturers away from distributors, but not too much because they need distributors, and you know, there are only three distributors of any scale in this business, and there are more than that in terms of number of suppliers. And again, you know, we've seen recently Lanco on the last call talked about consolidating more of their business with their top distributors. So there's again that silver lining of, you know, maybe higher volume at lower markup or something like that. I think also online pharmacies will continue to take market share. It's from a low base, and I think that given the relationship you have with your vet, and for those of you who have an animal, you probably, you know, if your vet tells you, hey, click here, you'll get your medicine, I'm not sure that many of you will go and shop around for the lowest price. Some of you will, and that's okay. You know, I'm not saying there will be no increase in online penetration for online pharmacies, but I don't think it's the majority of people. I don't think it's that kind of a purchase where you need to really get the bottom dollar and go someplace and so forth. But it's possible. It's a real risk, something I'm watching carefully. So I think my kind of range of possible outcomes for long-term sales growth of the distribution business is kind of in the 0-5% range versus a history of north of 5%. And the base case of low single digits. And that's partly because of online pharmacies, partly because of the supplier pressure I mentioned. Switching gears to Vet's First Choice. So there's really three key variables for Vet's First Choice. The first one is the number of practices in the US on the platform. The second is the degree of in-practice usage and commitment by the vets. And then there's also the potential to enter new geographies, which we can talk about. You can see on this chart, bottom of page 26, that this business is really following those early stages of an S-curve. So there's about 30,000 vet clinics in North America, and they started from less than 10% penetration to, by the end of 2018, they were at about 30% penetration. And if we switch to now, they're even higher than that. And I think that it's important to understand that signing up a practice does pretty little. You know, you don't get anything for showing up and getting them to install your system other than really a chance to then sell them on using it appropriately. And it's the usage and getting the vets real buy-in that truly basically drives the economics, because it's a revenue share model. The good news here is that old cohorts are still growing double digits, and that's pretty impressive. You know, so it's not like you have some big, you know, hit in usage, you know, people, you know, figure out some use case and that's it. You know, there is a lot of untapped potential to take people who've been using it for a year or two and move them up the kind of the ramp and the experience ramp and get them to generate more revenue for themselves and for the, you know, for Vet's First Choice. The best practitioners are averaging well over 100,000 in revenue per practice, revenue to Covetrus, versus the average of 30,000 for the install base. So there's a lot of promise here. And that 30,000 average is really influenced by the rapid growth. So here, if you look at the last 5 quarters, this business went from 8,000 practices at the end of 2019, Q1 of 2019, to 10,500 practices at the end of last quarter. So over a year, they added 2.5 practices, or essentially, you know, maybe 800-900 basis points of penetration. So when you bring on these newer customers, they're bringing down your average annualized revenue per practice because they're still new. They're early on their kind of usage journey. And so you're not going to get, you know, the average to move up as long as you're growing rapidly. Recently, management actually said, we're going to actually slow down the growth in practices because we really want to drive. We already have 40% plus of the industry on these systems. We kind of want to now focus on penetrating the practice and have the sales reps spend their time not pitching necessarily the next hospital as much, still some, but really getting the usage up. And that's what I would expect to see if the thesis is tracking, is that, you know, maybe slower practice growth, but that doesn't necessarily mean the worse revenue growth. You can see this business has been growing at 30% for a year, and COVID actually accelerated that growth rate. And I think that we saw 46% in Q1, and I wouldn't be surprised if it went higher. I mean, I don't know, these are really high growth rates, so it's hard to be sure. But the point is that COVID and the whole social distancing and, you know, paradigm has gotten vets to really be open to, you know, pushing the usage of this. So that's good. So in some sense, you know, if you think about companies that are, you know, fragile, to use telebs and analog in a resilient or anti-fragile, you know, in this case, with respect to the coronavirus crisis and social distancing, there's an anti-fragile component to Covetrus as far as, you know, they do to some degree better, you know, if the virus takes a more severe path. The old management began to enter the EU market, and the new management stopped that for now. And the reason is it's kind of hard to build out a new market, and they also want to get everyone focused and not distracted on the new initiative when there's so much untapped potential in the current kind of landscape. But I do think that they will try to enter eventually, but it probably will be later than originally thought. All right, so you know, almost done. I'll say, you know, 5 minutes, bear with me, and then I'll let John ask all your questions if there are some. But here's my kind of quick model for best first choice. You know, there are a total of 30,000 practices. I'm assuming that they get to 45% penetration in 5 years, which would be 13,500 practices, as compared to right, the last quarter was 10,500. So another 3,000 practices over 5 years, certainly far from heroic. I'm assuming 80,000 revenue per practice per year, which is much higher than the current 30K. But that's partly because, again, the 30K is depressed by all these new practices that just onboarded, and they're going to slow down the growth rate and try to penetrate deeper. And this is, you know, certainly lower than what management thinks. Doesn't mean that's right, you know, and certainly there's risk to that. But and I think there's a range of possibilities here, as there is with everything. It's also not clear whether they'll enter Europe or not. I'm only assuming that they hit 10% penetration in 5 years, which is much lower than where they are today in North America, and that the revenue per practice is half because there's some structural differences in the EU market that make it a less attractive market, but there's a higher number of clinics in the EU than North America, so that kind of offsets it a little bit. So I think we're gonna go from a business that's currently doing about 300 million run rate in revenue to a business that's doing north of a billion in my base case. So that's a big deal because unlike the core distribution business, which is a low margin business, here we have a very high, or at least relatively high, flow through incremental margin of about 25%. So that business, you know, adding $1 billion in revenue is going to drop down, you know, a decent amount in profitability. So for a company that, you know, just one way to look at it, this company, that's first choice, is adding right around zero right now, just slightly positive, and it's a $17 stock or something like that. So my expectations in 5 years in my base case, that this business alone, without the distribution business, would be generating north of a dollar in profits. And that's a big swing, right? You know, from so basically, if you take a company and you say, okay, even if the distribution business doesn't grow, you have a dollar and 15 cents or something like that. And the range is wide. And I would say that there is definitely a very interesting right tail here. This is a business that's both competitively advantaged and has the ability to grow for a long time. So, you know, think of a Phil Fisher compounder, which is a term that's overused, I think, but in this case, I think it's applicable. And it has a track record of doing that for many years. So it's not something that's just happened, and I'm assuming extrapolating the last 2-3 quarters, this has been happening for a while. And yet there's still a lot of untapped potential. So I think that there's room for positive surprises, and the range of possibilities, you know, for this business is certainly wide with, I would argue, upside potential. Going to the Covetrus distribution side, you have a business that's kind of underperforming a little bit. My, you know, base case is this is a business that is going to have slightly lower margins than history, partly because of that supplier pressure that I mentioned. They're going to get some integration synergies as their transition agreements fall off that have duplicative costs, maybe cut a little bit of headquarters costs. But by and large, I don't expect this business to be drastically different than history. It's kind of the steady Eddie, you know, business with not a lot of variability. And there's some range, but I think this is a kind of a narrow range of outcomes business, which I like. So it's a nice combination. You have this business that I think provides a nice base load of the business, a free cash flow stream, and you have a high growth early stage business to complement that. So I think it's a really unique combination. I don't think I know any other business like that. If you do, you know, I'll show you my email at the end of this presentation. Send me an email. I'm open-minded to looking at all possibilities out there, but I think this is a pretty unique combination in my experience. So if we go to valuation, you know, I think that first I value the two businesses separately because slapping some multiple on current combined EPS is partly what the market is missing, because Vet's First Choice is contributing next to nothing right now in profit. So, you know, it's kind of hidden in there. And this is a business I think is actually likely to be more valuable although with a higher, wider range of outcomes than is the distribution business. So I have a range here. Basically, I'm assuming it takes them 5 years to reach these economics for base and best case, and 2 years to reach the much lower worst case economics, assuming the business plateaus sooner than I anticipate. And the range of, you know, intrinsic value per share is between $4 and $65, which you can say, oh, gee, Gary, that's pretty useful, right? But that kind of highlights the right tail of that potential. My base case, which is based on these assumptions right here that we talked about, which I think they're what a base case should be, just about the middle part of the probability distribution. So that basically gets a high teens value per share. But obviously, this is not precise science. There's a lot of variability, but it's a very valuable business in my view. Just as a thought exercise, if you had a SaaS company growing 30-40% per year with good incremental margins and a strong competitive advantage and a long runway, with $300 million revenue in the current market, which I'm not saying is right or wrong, but you'll be trading at between 5 and 10 times revenues easily. So, I think that these are not crazy numbers, and they're also not crazy numbers in the sense that I'm valuing this business at about 24 times mature on a P basis discounted today. So if we take that $16 and discount to bring it back to today as a forward 12 month number, then that 17 translates to about 24 times those earnings. So I'm not banking on some kind of crazy valuation here. Now putting it together, now this is the traditional business. So I'm valuing that. And then I'm adding the Vets First Choice business as based on the other valuation that I just showed you before. And that's how we get to a range of values, which is between 10 and 87 with a high 20s base case. And that puts the stock at about 60 cents on the dollar. There is some downside now, but I would say that the right tail of probabilities is far more open based on the SaaS business really, picking up steam over the next 4 or 5 years than I would say the left tail. I mean, with the balance sheet risk reduced, it's really hard to lose a lot of money here. By the way, it doesn't mean the stock can't, if the market drops, the stock can go anywhere, like we've seen this, right? So I'm not at all saying that the stock won't go anywhere. I just think that if we owned the whole business outright, it would be hard to believe we would lose a ton of money over time here. But it's possible, and that's why you always want to be careful. So if I look at sensitivity as my assumptions, if I look at my base case, it would drop 8% if there was no Vets First Choice entry into the EU, 16 if North America stopped growing practices at today's level, 27 if the revenue per practice was 50K instead of 80K. I'll let you look at the slide. I don't want to go through every single one. The point is we can be wrong on one or two things here in a major way and still have this be a decent investment. And that kind of speaks to a little bit of the margin of safety we still have despite the stock run up. There are a couple of catalysts on the horizon, though. First of all, I think that the distribution business turning around and the new management is one catalyst. Another catalyst is that, vets, people, react to profits they see. And so when Vets First Choice, continues to grow sales and starts to drop through nice profits to the bottom line, and we go from a business that used to be losing money to that was a break even, just started to make money, we're at that cusp inflection point where it's going to rapidly start to add to the bottom line. So that will be in a nice way for people to recognize that business is quite valuable. And also, I didn't put it in the slide, but CD&R, the PE shop, does have a big stake. You know how PE shops work; they want an exit. So I wouldn't be surprised if they try to have an exit. Now I would suppose, they don't want an exit at 30% profits. They want a 2-3-4-bagger over 4 or 5 years. So it doesn't mean that they'll achieve it, but at least I think there is a motivated person making sure that if there is a strategic fit with someone else, that these guys could be bought by someone else. So behavioral checklist, I think that you always want to see what are your biases, where could you be, making systemic mistakes in your thinking. I actually formed the Devil's Advocate Club, as I call it, with a few other investors, I respect, where the idea is we basically present the strongest, well-researched, opposite opinion. And I've requested, since this has become with the stock appreciation my largest position, I've requested that we do this one. So I'm waiting for a couple of the members that are going to tag team this and tell me where I'm wrong. So I'm definitely very much open. I seek out opposing points of view, and I would encourage you to do the same. I think if you think you have all the answers, you're missing it. We're going to be wrong a lot in this business, and if we can lower that error rate, it's good to seek out intelligent opposite point of view. So I'm in the process of doing that. And, you know, I think like all of us, I'm probably somewhat anchored, but I don't know if there are any other specific biases that I can identify, and maybe the devil's advocate presentation process will help me with that. So the big high-level risks, I would say, are threefold. One is I'm wrong in the online pharmacy threat, and drug sales really do leave that channel for good over time. That would be a big problem. The second possibility is the suppliers extract much more economics from distributors they expect. And the third problem is that, you know, somehow Vet's First Choice hits a wall that the, you know, some of the better clients are doing 100K plus in revenue, just completely not representative of the average tendency of the whole, you know, stall base. And I'm just over extrapolating recent growth and over optimistic about the long-term possibility of the business. And this is definitely a thesis that needs monitoring. This is, you know, something that I think that as quarters and years come out, we need to update the thesis and say, hey, are these risks more or less likely? That's one of the things that I'm watching for as, you know, the company reports results. I'm not watching what their EPS is to decimal places. I'm watching for evidence of positive or negative developments on these kind of issues. You know, just a little bit about my portfolio construction process, and I'll turn it over to John after that. You know, typically, based on quality, I have different thresholds in terms of price as a percentage of base case value. And, you know, I will not pay more than 75 cents on the dollar of value, but more typically, I buy things under 2/3 of intrinsic value. And in terms of position sizes, I, you know, have a rather simple system of small, medium, and large, of 5%, 10%, 15%. And the partnership typically has about, you know, between 8, you know, between 10 and 15 investments at a time, something like that. And, you know, so these are the criteria to become a larger investment is not just cheapness, but it's also lower downside to my worst case and higher quality. So ideally, I want my large positions to not just be undervalued. I want all my positions to be undervalued, but I also want them to have limited downside, and I want them to have a, you know, at least above average a level of quality for the large positions. So this is my kind of last slide here. You know, this is the history I have with Covetrus. I'm pretty transparent here. You know, I initiated this as a small position October 2019 when the old CEO was announced to be in the process of being replaced, and the stock, you know, gapped down to $9, which I thought was an extremely attractive price. So I started a small position. We didn't have a lot of spare capital at that point. Actually, in February 2020, before the COVID crisis exploded, I added a $12 and make it a medium position. And the reason is I think the business progress, you know, gave me confidence that my range of values was higher than I originally thought. And I also had some free capital at that point. So I wanted to, you know, take an appropriately large position for the quality and the downside for the business, because with downside to, at that point, was high single digits, $9, $10. You know, there was not a lot of downside in my view on a long-term basis at $12. In March and April, this stock got caught up with the same, you know, basket trade of companies with high nominal leverage, where whoever is shorting or selling these baskets brings them, you know, to absurd valuations, which I don't mind at all. I actually love it. And I made a big, big, big increase in the number of shares in price between $5 and $9 to restore the 10% position size. And as you see from my kind of presentation, I believe, you know, hopefully correctly, that these are truly irrational prices. You know, at those prices, you're paying less than either of those businesses are worth for both of them. I recently did reduce the position, you know, simply because reduced it by about a fifth, and that's simply because the stock, as it went up, just became such a large position in the portfolio that I have my risk parameters that I don't want to. No, I want to be able to, you know, add value to my partners based on, you know, my typical decisions over time, not based on some one big amazing hit. And nor do I want to, if I'm wrong, lose so much of the portfolio on some one investment that, you know, I can't easily recover that from my other investments. Still my current number one position, and I still think there's a lot of upside here. So I was selling it very reluctantly, just the bare minimum I needed to bring it in line with my risk parameters. This slide says, don't sue me and do your own work. And this is my contact information. I'm going to leave it on the screen. And if John, if there are any questions, I'm all yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Gary, for the presentation. To everyone listening, if you do have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface at this time. I am showing a couple of questions already, so I'll just read the first one. Given the obvious conflicts of interest, physicians are no longer allowed to own in-house test labs or get kickbacks on medical prescriptions. Any concern that regulation will impact the vet space?
It's a fair question. I'm paranoid by nature, or as my wife says, pessimistic by nature, and think about things that can go wrong. So sure, there are concerns, but I don't think that, there's a movement to limit this. And you would have to, again, vets make a lot less money than doctors. So you would have to somehow restore the economics to the vet, right? So never say never. The really horrible scenario, right, for this company and for the industry would be that all of a sudden vets can only write prescriptions, or they only do write prescriptions, and those prescriptions have to be fulfilled at a small number of large retail chains. And therefore, the value of the distribution link in the value chain greatly diminishes. So, yeah, I mean, it's a legitimate concern. Have I seen evidence of that in the process of happening or likely to happen? No. I mean, this business has been around for a long time. So I guess the question is, if regulators were to step in, who is being victimized here, I guess, especially since there's not competition and the client can request a prescription to, say, Chewy's and say, hey, Mr. Vet, I don't want to buy from you. I want to buy. Can you please e-prescribe to Chewy's and I'll fulfill there? So I think as long as there's not some abuse happening over the client, I don't see a reason for the regulator to step in and try to harass the vets who are barely making ends meet after like huge number and dollar what value of loans that they need to go through vet school. So I'm not particularly worried about that, but it's a risk. I just think it's a low probability.
Can you elaborate on capital allocation going forward? Where would you like to see the priorities?
Yeah, so I think that right now, I would say that they're kind of in a hunker down mode and execution mode. So I would not expect large acquisitions. I would be surprised, probably negatively surprised, unless the price was amazing, which is unlikely for large deals. I would like to see capital return at some point. And I think that as the business, Vets First Choice ramps up and they do show evidence of turning around the distribution business, I think we can see share buybacks. It's unfortunate, right? Like ideally, right, we would be buying shares back at six and not at 20, whatever it is, but that might happen. And I think that as long as they keep growing the value of the business and there's a meaningful price to value gap, I would say I would like a thoughtful, share buyback strategy. By thoughtful, I mean not like most CEOs where they buy high and don't buy low, but thoughtful as it's guided by their assessment of price and value. But I mean, I will settle for just a normal return of capital. I don't expect them. I'm not modeling certainly any meaningful addition in terms of value through capital reinvestment because the businesses don't really require that. So in the classic Phil Fisher compounder, you have high returns on capital, higher incremental returns, and you have high amount of incremental capital you can deploy. Well, here you're getting high growth from Vets First Choice without high amount of incremental capital. You have to invest a lot of fixed costs up front, and you have to invest in the sales force. So I would actually almost rather seeing them, if it's warranted, reinvest into the sales force and therefore lower accounting profits that we all see, which maybe other short-term investors would disagree with, but that's fine. I don't care if they trash their P&L for a year or two, if that can allows them to press the competitive advantage and accelerate the Vets First Choice rollout and long-term economics. So I guess if there is a way to reinvest thoughtfully in a sales force, I would say that would be number one. And I would say number two would be intelligent return of capital.
What would be the key data points to track to either validate or challenge your thesis over time?
I would say on the distribution side, I look at all three of the majors, Patterson, MWI, which is part of AmerisourceBergen, and Covetrus, and I would say if the industry growth rate itself started to meaningfully decline or decelerate, certainly, That would be a yellow to red flag, you know, because, you know, what's the reason for that? It's not a cyclical business, so there shouldn't be a reason other than potentially some of the risks coming to fruition, such as, you know, online shifts in pharmacy. So I'm not worried about, you know, Chewy saying we went from 1 million pharmacy customers to 2 million. I expect that's normal. They have whatever 10 plus million customers at Chewy, so I expect they will penetrate their customer base and grow their customer base. What I would be worried is if the magnitude of that was translating into industry level deceleration. You know, with the new head of North American distribution, I expect that they're, you know, the turnaround is not going to necessarily be smooth. So I'm not so much worried if Covetrus's organic revenue and distribution business are a little bumpy for the next, you know, 2 to 6 quarters, you know, 2 to 4 quarters. While he kind of, you know, I think they're going to improve the sales force incentives, and, you know, there's usually some turbulence when you change incentives for the sales force. But I would be much more worried if at the industry level the growth rate sharply decelerate or even start to shrink. And on the Covetra side, I mean, I would not be worried if the growth number of practices slow down. But if that's growth slow down and the revenue growth slightly slow down, which means that, you know, their thesis is that, look, we're going to slow down the growth and number of practices in order to better penetrate existing practices. So the evidence that we should see is that the practice number growing slower year over year, but the revenue growth, you know, remaining quite strong because the revenue per practice is going up. If we don't see the revenue per practice meaningfully going up, and we see a slowdown in the growth number of practices, that could be evidence that maybe they hit a wall, right? And maybe, you know, when we think about the S curve of that business, maybe the plateau is much sooner than we think. And I talked to my vet, and I asked him what he thought. He said, "Look, I don't use them because I don't want to hand over all my data to them. I don't want to have them, you know, do stuff." But there are concerns. They're not usually economic concerns, but I think like there are roadblocks to usage, and we don't yet know how prevalent those roadblocks are. So we don't know if the people who are doing 200K in revenue or whatever per year, if they're just, you know, early adopters, you know, just exceptions that we'll never see anything close to, or if there's a way to bring many people a lot closer to that. So those are the two things that I'll be most worried about.
Great. Well, that's very helpful. Gary, we will leave it here. Thank you again very much for being part of WideMoat Investing Summit and sharing such an in-depth presentation with our members. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, John, for having me, and have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks also to everyone listening. Feel free to reach out to Gary. We're showing his contact information here on the screen. I'm sure he'd love to hear from anyone with their own thoughts or questions. Goodbye for now.